Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Kazem Ali. Kazem Ali is the author of two books of poetry, The Far Mosque and The 40th Day, two novels, Quinn's Passage and The Disappearance of Seth, a memoir, Bright Felon, Autobiography and Cities, an essay collection, Orange Alert, and a collection of journals called Fasting for Ramadan, Notes on a Spiritual Practice. He is an associate professor of creative writing and comparative literature at Oberlin College, and he has been a regular columnist for American Poetry Review. Kazem, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start us off with some poems from the 40th day?
This is a poem called Lostness. Dear God of blankness, I pray to dear unerasable, how could I live without you if I were ever given answers? The summer thickens with lostness, lovers who will not touch each other, but look out into space, thinking, I do not belong in the world. News always travels inland, but how can this storm be undone, or the treacherous rain unravel, or the train arriving one street over and all night long on an island at the end of islands, a forsworn vow, a river blasted through and another river filled in. Dear afternoon God, dear evening God, my lonely world, the circles of water and wanton violence. Dear utterly unmistakable ether, dear lostness, your careless supplicant drops everything and rakes over me on his way to an implacable place. So I lived, at the time I wrote this book, in Beacon, New York, and looming over the town of Beacon is Mount Beacon, which in East Coast terms is a mountain, although if you were from the West Coast, maybe you wouldn't think of it as more than a very large hill. At any rate, one of the great sights of Beacon is the changing of the leaves' colors. And so I was sitting there one fall after hearing the news of the death of a friend, and I wrote this very brief poem. It's called Morning Prayer. And I always apologize that the talking about this poem is always longer than the poem. It's only 8 short lines. But here's Morning Prayer. The work of dark, a tremulous sound. Mount Beacon, season to season, changes or is changed. What's in us that reaches to know what's after? Should I draw the spirit as a lantern or a cup? And then this poem, of course, the next poem is called Dear Lantern, Dear Cup. And I wrote it a long time after this poem, and it appears in my book a long time after, but I'll read it right away so you can get the sense of the sequel, the sequelness of that. Dear lantern, dear cup, will you light the way or will you hold me? Dear earthquake in the ground, who is waiting? Am I shining out into infinite space, or will I be spilled? So these are the things that I think about at night. I want to read a poem that's called Cave, which is a little bit about the creative process, I suppose. Some people have a kind of like hotwired into the ether, and then some of us struggle to write. It refers to a myth of the Quran, that's in the Quran, of the early days of the prophet, when he was being chased through the mountains by these soldiers, and he hid inside a cave, and they didn't follow him because a spider dropped across the mouth of the cave and immediately started spinning a web. And so they went on and left him, and he was rescued. But before he could leave the cave with the spider web still across the mouth of the cave, the angel came and started whispering the Quran to him. So I refer to that a little bit in this poem, which is called, after all, Cave, as a place of revelation. There is a web of blue and green in his dream. seedlings of sky and grass thrusting up from the ground. Years after his promise to his body was broken and the silver cord severed, the spirit sent like a ghost ship to trawl the dream terrain, wrinkled and blue. Music leaks roughly from the body, the way the stomach empties itself of vomit. Days and days after, he stays weak, making the promise, writing it into all the crevices and corners. One vow could cut through all the surf, commend him to a steady stream of silver cords. But isn't it better, his tricky innards reason with him, to be like this? Lost, afraid, hungry, and alone, deafened in the cave of your own breath, no web spun across the mouth, no angel whispering inside.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Kazem Ali, reading from his poetry collection, The 40th Day. So the sense of questioning is very, very present in The 40th Day. From the first poem that you read, Lostness, with that, how could I live without you if I were ever given answers, which is a startling approach, I think, for someone who's speaking in a sort of mystical voice to be afraid of having answers. And then you have these other interesting moments of even asking what someone should pray for in that last poem that you read. Can you talk about the questioning in the work?
Well, I guess it's interesting that you say that, I don't remember exactly how you put it, but to talk about this idea of questions and not being afraid of being given answers. But to me, I think if you have answers, then you have no more questions. I mean, this is what I thought when I was writing this book. At some point when you receive answers, you may ask deeper questions or more questions after it. And I think that's more along the lines of what I'm thinking now. At the moment, instead of being afraid of receiving answers, maybe being excited to get some beginning answers in order to ask more questions or additional questions. But I think in a spiritual search, if you received an answer, I mean, we're in this life and we are wondering, you know, what is happening? Who are we? What is this world that we're in? It seems kind of miserable at times. What is it all about? What are we doing here? What is it for? So it all boils down to those, what I think of as these sort of three essential questions, which is, where did I come from? Who am I? And where am I going? What happens after? And, you know, especially if we're blessed with a lot of time here, it seems like there must be a lot to figure out. And it seems like the longer you're here, the more you should be questioning and continuing to learn. So I hope I'll always be a student. I hope I'll always be confused, you know, and even if I hope I'm not confused about the same things continuously, but I hope I'm always in that beginning stage of wondering. I picked up from Gertrude Stein the tick of not actually using question marks, although some of the poems in this book do have question marks in them. That first poem that I read to you doesn't. So the grammar of the sentence is phrased as a question, but the punctuation is not there. And so the questioning to me is actually deeper. It doesn't signal in any obvious way that an answer is actually being asked for. It's actually the question in its own essential nature as a question. And that really appeals to me a lot. There's no punctuation of any kind in the poem Lostness, including periods. And some of the lines do end in sentences and begin new ones, but there's no indication of that. I think there's two capitalized words in the whole poem, and they're not necessarily the beginnings of sentences. So there is something about the defamiliarization inherent in that was really exciting to me. It's not something I've done a lot in every poem in the book even, but
I can see how that technique gives the poem a kind of openness. And one of the things I was going to ask you was how you go about, because the poems the book as a whole and the poems individually do have that, a very mystical air around them and a very, that sense about the language. And I wanted to know how you access that voice.
I'm not sure. One of the things that this book has been criticized for and that I have been read a critique of my writing of is the sort of non-connection to the actual physical world, that it is so philosophical or spiritual. But to me, I never took that as a criticism. I took that as actually a confirmation. And the issue for me is that I feel that the book is full of the physical world. I mean, I'm checking my tires and, you know, I'm talking about Marble Hill, where I used to live, which is where they blasted a river through, you know, to, you know, Manhattan ends at 218th Street and then the Bronx starts at 225th Street. Well, actually, it used to go all the way through. And that, you know, so I do talk about actual physical things, but I guess I'm more obsessed with the implications. What I seem to be less interested in this book, I guess, is the more basic quotidian stories of my actual life as I was telling it. But I wrote about all of that in Bright Felon, so I guess I didn't want to write the same book over and over again. I wanted to, in each book, have a different sort of attention and a different level of focus. And to me, in The 40th Day, it was more of the rhythm of thought or the ecstasy of language that was more exciting.
Can you read to us more from that?
From The 40th Day?
Sure.
Yes, I can do that. Well, how about this? This is a good example of what I think of as a narrative poem. You know, it tells a story of a young man who's, you know, a bird has crashed into the window and the window has broken and he has to sweep up the glass. So that's pretty basic. He's got to do a chore. And so this poem is called Ornithography. Sunlight alarms the room, tattered by time and the failed window. Dust motes taking note of the yellow as it passes through the glass in bars without breaking. A difficult spill from the blue, leading to an idea. The sky is you. The bird was you. The glass was you. Are you still, though all broken? If you sail out on your boat, will the air unroll? Will it open into navigable paths? Will you single out the sound that lingers? A bow that shivers along the strings, a transcription of the sight of 500 wings, dreaming a sudden maze, whose feathered arms are gesturing through dust's field of vision, when you, the boat's wake, when the rudder drifts, the surface is still. Is it really still, since still reaches back and threads the idea of the boat to the idea of water? Chores here are choral. The chords of your work connect you, crouched in the shade, dustpan in hand. If lingering is the wind, if the waves of the sky road are really wind, water is waves. If the boat sails through the mist, will the island coalesce? Will you coalesce? Of dust and light and broken glass, who has to sweep? Who has to patch the empty frame? Who is going to fly back to blue? I'll read a pair of poems next. This one, the first is called The Ocean Floor, and the next one is called Sleep Door. And they did not mean to go together, but they ended up in the book together, and they're both about being underwater. So I figure I'll read them one after the other. And Sleep Door plagiarizes an early poem of mine from my first book, The Far Mosque. And this was also an unintentional plagiarism. Many years later, looking at this line in The 40th Day, realized I had written a poem with that exact same line in The Far Mosque. So I think you're allowed to plagiarize yourself, though, right? That's not really...
I think they'll get away with that.
Yeah. So here is The Ocean Floor. The ocean floor, dreamt of being under a spell, a creature prisoned to the ocean floor. What decades I spell looking up through acres of water to surface light, the black ovals of ship hulls passing over. Sound travels so slowly at the bottom of the ocean. Somehow I'm not drowning. My supposed deafness fishes from water the sound of an orchestra in which all the instruments play separately from one another and out of tune. And here is Sleep Door. A light knocking on the sleep door, like the sound of a rope striking the side of a boat heard underwater. Boats pulling up alongside each other, beneath the surface we rub up against each other. Will we capsize in the surge and silence of waking from sleep? You are a lost canoe navigating by me. I am the star map tonight. All the failed echoes don't matter. The painted over murals don't matter. You can't find your way to me by the faint star lamp. We are a fleet now, our prows zeroing in, praying in the wind to spin like haywire compasses toward whichever direction will have us.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Kazem Ali, reading from his books, The 40th Day and Bright Felon, Autobiography and Cities. You mentioned this a little earlier about how you work on different projects in different books. And something that's remarkably different between the first two books of poetry and then Bright Felon, which is poetry, autobiography, sort of a bit of a cross-genre mix, is that the narrator, or the speaker, excuse me, in Bright Felon becomes much more present. I'm curious what happened that shifted.
Well, you're right. Bright Felon is both. I mean, it's poetry, it's autobiography, it's prose, it's, you know, writing about cities, it's a lot of different things. And although it's a remembrance, I never wanted to call it a memoir, but the closest thing I could come to as a genre description for it was autobiography, a text about my own life. And, you know, I was writing it in an immediately sentence by sentence. And I did some crafting and some tweaking, but very little revision of the actual project. It was written pretty much in the form it appears in the book. And I wrote the first draft of it in 5 months. And then about a year later, I went back and revised and made it better, really, with the help of some, you know, people who read it and helped me, gave me a lot of really good feedback. But as a speaking self, I feel in the poetry of the 40th day and certainly in the poetry of the Far Mosque, maybe I was moving towards, I don't want to say oracular voice because I wasn't claiming to actually see anything, but a more musical, maybe a voice of a musical instrument, and the body itself, as Sappho said, as a speaking instrument. And so it was me. And so this question of subjectivity or who is the one doing the speaking here, I felt maybe more like a cellist playing a cello, but the cello would happen to be me. Maybe I was the cello and the cellist both, but there was some kind of relationship there that was a little bit different. In Bright Felon, I really felt like, okay, like I'm going to sit down and explain to you a couple of things about me. I felt like I was speaking much more directly to a reader or to myself in a certain case, because the person switches in Bright Felon a little bit. And a lot of times I felt like I was really writing that book to save my own life, which I did with it. So that was good, successful.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that.
And in my new poetry manuscript, the poems that I'm working on now, I'm really trying to bring that level of speaking subjectivity from Bright Felon and the very musical and rhythmic concerns of my earlier poetry books together. So it feels kind of, it's really fresh and new and fun for me to be working on this. It'll be a while before anything is presentable, but.
That'll be exciting to see.
Yeah.
Can we hear some work from Bright Felon?
Yes, I'll read you a little piece. So I'm going to read this chapter called Carlisle. This is the second chapter in the book. And I was living, of course, I taught at Shippensburg University for a couple of years. My wonderful, wonderful students in creative writing that I taught there, I'm really excited about. Some of them have gone on to doing grad school, and one of my students named Heather Palmer has published, just very recently published a book. So she's the first former student of mine who's actually published a book. So I hope that y'all listeners will keep your eyes open for Heather Palmer. So this chapter, so Carlisle, I lived in Carlisle during the 2006-2007 academic year. And this is the chapter. Because what I think is that this tender beast, brown-skinned animal, grotesque and lustful, is me and my immortal soul besides. In Carlisle, I have two writing desks on opposite sides of my apartment. Both of these I bought with money from my first real job when I moved north of the city to Rhinebeck. But this is a part of the story I haven't gotten to yet, though it was already years ago. Always in the broken story, there is more to tell. Mornings I rise in the cold and walk two blocks down to the old colonial graveyard to read history in the broken stones, names sometimes worn away, the stories of first wives, second wives, dead infants, and unmarked who's. In this way, I read the history of the place. The history of any place is simple for me, a route between my home on South Bedford Street, across the main intersection to the coffee shop on the corner of Pitt and High Street. The other compass points are the independent bookstore, the used bookstore, the house on Hanover Street where Marianne Moore lived, and a strange park that was once a graveyard on the north side of town, a place where the land was broken and bones disturbed. Details on the display plaques in that park are sketchy and will lead me into shadowed places, the town records, rooms I've never been. But I don't discover the small park near the railroad tracks with its distressing history until I've lived in the town more than 7 months. In the body of a tree, I hear a resonance, while out in space between planets lie cores of planets. An iron fence grows through the heart of the tree. I pass it every day in the morning when I walk. You were saying something. What I learned is that each asteroid is held in careful place by a partner in space, and that if such a body didn't exist, the orbital patterns of these same could be extrapolated graphically, a discovery which pleases me almost as much as when I learned that every cubic equation actually has an associated modular form. But is the reverse true? And what has all this to do with Carlisle, Pennsylvania, once a frontier town, but constructed at the frontier with specific intent to push the boundaries of the state out to the Cumberland Pass? I wrote an autobiography once in letters to someone in which I found myself unable to actually say anything, so I tried saying it in two or three or four different versions, eventually leaving all the various versions in, repeating the chapters in different variations so I could speak out of both sides of my mouth, not because I wanted to evade, but because I didn't know what really happened. The county jail, Gothic redstone, still stands at the corner of Bedford and High Streets, though it is offices now, the insides completely refurbished with industrial gray carpeting, drop ceilings, and fluorescent lights. You have to squint at it to be fearful, though death it still tells. A white man crushed in riots when he tried to sue for the return of two of his slaves that had escaped north. I need to check whether or not he won his case. To live in a frontier town at any rate, or a town that was built on what was supposed to be the frontier. Later, all the promises were broken and the settlements spread into the territories. It's always the broken that holds the universe in place. That's what I would say about poetry and prayer, that God or audience, the intended direction of both of those, we wish and wish are real. In the mornings of the late fall, when it is cold enough to feel the winter beginning, I would leave the house very early and walk south on Bedford Street into the old cemetery. Here is the closest place you come to in America to a city piled on top of a city. It's not like that in Cairo, where the city sedimented itself and we walked down the Greek streets, saw churches hidden underground, accessible only by otherwise unmarked staircases in empty courtyards. Through the cemetery, I read the fate of the village, the deaths, the family trees, the broken headstones, how we will all break. When I speak about my body's life, I know it is brothered and descended from, but do not know if blood will descend from my blood. Does a family break, or can it, like water, evaporate and condense, and so will I then be a father in a million different ways? Leaving the cemetery, I walk through the old districts to the north side of town, and after crossing the railroad tracks, find a park there, which is really another cemetery, or was. The graves now all dug up, replaced by a small green park. One grave is surrounded by a small iron fence. The granddaughter of this man lived across the street, and when the park was planned, she battled to have this grave protected, and so it was. The others, descendantless, have disappeared, the headstones shattered and removed, the ground planted over. As I walk, I realize likely the bodies and bones remain deep underground, still dissipating. You know without explanation whose graveyard that was torn up. You understand the color of their skin that enabled their desecration and what station they occupied in this community while they lived. Why should I spell out every little thing? There are things about a person's body you do not know, the things it craves and loves, all the sordid things we could never tell, the cheap things, tawdry and paltry. Carlisle, where soldiers are trained and Indians were brought to be forced to forget. Never did I think when I arrived there that it would be the place I would sort myself out and dare actually to speak. Nothing happened there but time, going in the morning to the coffee shop to read or write. How ordinary the most important things are. The green copper roofs of the buildings against the steel blue gray of the central Pennsylvania sky. You could look at anything and understand. In the sky, in the rain-wet street, in the palm of your hand, is always what you promised to understand. Maybe you are never going to get there. I thought I wouldn't get there unless I spoke, unless I told about the people I love, the picture I drew against the corner of the room. Listen, I am trying to tell you how ridiculously hard it was to even try to open my mouth, to make words, let alone sentences, how silence can fill every space. To drown in a river or to lift the water up and let the drowning be your guide. I trudge along the street, unbaptized and criminal according to some religious laws. Lonely brother, middle child, only son. Is it written on my skin, my friend asks? Is that why you could never go on pilgrimage, never go to Mecca? But why is it I would want to go to Mecca? Because there a stone fell from the sky? But more importantly than that small thing, that is where a mother refused to believe. A mother refused to believe the obvious. I am alone in the desert with my son. His breath rattles in his throat. We have been left here by the patriarch who promised to return. Sound familiar? He left us, and we were promised by God to safety. That is the question of faith on the frontier. You were promised deliverance, yet there you are, no water in sight. Do you sit and wait for the angel to either spell it all out into your ears or perhaps write it onto your skin? Yet I think it is already written on my face, written into every corner as many times as I could say it. There must be water around here somewhere. It is in panic to leave a baby even then in the moment of dying. And that is how it happened. God wouldn't spell it out. Rather, the water came exactly where she put the boy down. After she risked it all for the impossible, water in the desert. In the desert, the mother was left. She had to decide. Do you wait for God to tell you what to do, or do you panic?
The poetry of Kazem Ali. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.